Next time you swing by the magazine stand, you might come across something called Lucky Peach. It's a food magazine, but don't expect 20 simple dinners you can make in 20 minutes. Instead, there's poetry, fiction, and also chefs swearing at each other. The first issue is focused on ramen, not those little packages we all made back in our college dorm rooms, but ramen as a delicacy with a rich and complicated history. Lucky Peach editor Peter Meehan created the magazine with New York noodle baron David Chang. Meehan says he once wrote a ramen recipe that was 30 pages long.
You spend 2 pages explaining what alkaline noodles are and what alkalinity in food is, and that's just the noodles, and then you talk about the broth and, you know, it's a dashi, and then it's a pork stock on top of that. And it's not just seasoned with soy sauce, but usually it's a soy sauce that's been cooked with other things called atare. So that 30 pages was trying to explain all of these components that go into making a bowl of ramen.
Don't worry, you're not going to find a 30-page ramen recipe in Lucky Peach, but you will find a sense of how important the soup is in Japanese culture.
There are people who spend every weekend, you know, going and finding new bowls, experiencing new ramen that is there around Japan. So if you go to Japan, there are literally 4 or 5 ramen magazines on the shelves at grocery stores, and they're filled with hundreds and hundreds of reviews of ramen shops and what goes into the broth and what this guy does. So
kind of overwhelming.
It's a big subculture there.
And I'm paging through the book now and the magazine, and the beginning of Lucky Peach is really a sort of a travel log of you and David Chang hanging out in Japan, searching for great ramen. And I was stunned because you ate this unbelievable amount of noodles. And you write that you guys, I mean, were almost sick.
No. We were very actually sick. we were there for, you know, we were in Tokyo for 6 or 7 days, and we ate as many bowls of ramen as we physically could. But it's rude to leave noodles in your bowl. So you go there and you crush these gigantic bowls of noodles. And, you know, it's in a very rich pork fatty broth. So there were only so many bowls we could get in 5 or 6 days with the other meals that we had planned to go to, but we tried to pack them all in.
And you said you spent a lot of nights drunk dreaming of noodles as you were going to bed in the hotel room.
That is a byproduct of eating noodles all day and then drinking all night.
So this is not a food magazine. This is like 170 pages of interesting tales of your travels. There are recipes. You swear a lot. I mean, what are you really going for? Is this a new kind of cookbook? Is it an experience?
You know, I mean, I think it's one of those things where you're sitting in a room and you're like, let's make a new food magazine. And that's a terrible idea. The world does not need a new food magazine. But
right.
If it's such a bad idea that you can do a good version of it, then that's a cool challenge.
This seems like sort of a strange time to jump into a new food magazine. I mean, a magazine like Gourmet gets shut down a couple of years ago. I mean, do you have a death wish? What makes you think this is going to really succeed?
I think it mainly is death wish. and it's disappointing to us that it's ended up being as popular as it's been. I mean, it's a small scale popularity, but we've done 2 pressings and it looks like we're going to go to a third.
The recipes in this book, these are not recipes from Grandma's cookbook. And you actually have one recipe in haiku. I'm looking at page 121. It's corn with miso, butter, and bacon, a recipe in haikus. Can you read that for me?
Oh, man. This is a dramatic reading of a recipe. This is a low point for me, I think. Hold on. Render the bacon, add the corn. Jump and sizzle as gold turns to brown. Miso and butter joined in equal proportions, plop into the pan. Splash stock, then toss. Glaze. Crack slow poached egg to crown like Hokkaido sunset.
That was beautiful. A little more emotion in the plop, but that was really that was very nice. I'm ready to cook it, and we're gonna try and taste some ramen because you really have us in the mood. If we find a noodle shop out here in Southern California, what should we be looking for? I mean, if we walk in the door, what will make us say this is a really great place?
When you eat ramen, you sit there, you bend yourself over the bowl when it's, you know, piping hot, right when it's been handed to you. And you're going to slurp those noodles. You're not chewing them. You're not cutting them up. You're trying to inhale them like a human noodle vacuum. And they should slurp in a pleasing way. And then that broth that they're served in, should dress the noodles. It should coat the noodles. It should flavor the noodles. And I think it seems like the simplest thing in the world for a bowl of noodle soup to do. But when you're in front of a bowl and that's happening, that's, you know, you're most of the way there.
We've been talking to Peter Meehan. He's the co-editor of Lucky Peach magazine, and he's quite a connoisseur of ramen noodles. Thanks for joining us, Peter.
Thanks so much for having me.
And after talking for that long about ramen, I mean, how could we go without tasting some? And so we came to this this Japanese market in L.A., and at the back there's a window and a kitchen. They are making and serving a lot of ramen. That was all I needed to hear. We talked our way back into that kitchen.
Could we ask you a question or two about ramen?
19-year-old Andrew Solo is one of the cooks.
What makes good ramen to you? Like, what's
the best? The soup makes it really good.
As for what's involved in making that soup, pork feet, pork ribs, fish bones, and they cook it all for 17 hours. 17 hours.
Yeah, and then we have to taste it before we take it.
As for Peter Meehan's 30-page ramen recipe?
30 pages?
30 pages.
Well, actually, the step is a lot, but I'm not surprised because it is hard to make ramen.
Of course, I wasn't leaving.
Salt ramen?
Just one salt?
One salt.
Without a taste.
It's really hot.
I'm sweating a little bit. Think it was worth the heat? You bet it was. I had to ask the manager.
What makes it milky? Is salt ramen always like a milkier?
It's my secret.
It's your secret.
Okay. It's really good.
Is it good?
It's amazing.
Thank you. Yeah, we're good.
So there's a taste of ramen from Santuca Ramen on South Centinela Avenue here in L.A.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. These days, farm subsidies are blamed for lots of things, even the nation's obesity epidemic. Critics say the billions of dollars in annual subsidies encourage farmers to grow too much grain. Prices drop, food gets cheaper, and we eat too much. Seems like a simple equation, except it's not. Reporter Frank Morris of member station KCUR and Harvest Public Media has this look at what's really going on.
It's a fact that Americans eat cheap. We spend, on average, less than 10% of our money on food. And though a lot of people, like the patrons of this Kansas City Burger King, are buying too much fast food, it's still a good economic decision.
The smartest, most rational decision is to eat the crappiest food, because everywhere you turn, it's more accessible, more affordable, and more convenient.
Dr. David Willinga at the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy in Minneapolis is one of the people who say federal farm subsidies lead directly to overeating.
What we've had is a cheap feed grain policy or a cheap calorie policy, and that's been pretty consistent from farm bill to farm bill over the last 30-odd years.
So the farm bill, that big bundle of legislation that includes agricultural subsidies, helps make us fat, right? Maybe not. Let's take a closer look at this whole picture.
I'm Ken McCauley. I'm a farmer from White Cloud, Kansas. We're standing on a farm just west of Highland, Kansas.
McCauley says that yes, he's growing more corn, but not because of subsidies.
The expansion that you're hearing about in agriculture today or for the past several years is all about the machinery and the ease of work. Your work's easier because of technology. Our work's easier because of machinery and technology.
As we talk, McCauley's son, Brad, charges back and forth over the land in a self-propelled sprayer. This thing looks like a monster bug, a green tractor on stilts with booms stretching 90 feet like enormous wings, trailing a finely calibrated mist of herbicide.
It steers itself, shuts itself on and off. So I basically just turn around and make sure everything's running right.
The spray kills everything but the corn, because the corn's been genetically engineered to withstand the herbicide. And for good measure, the corn's also been designed to produce its own insecticide. So now the corn plants grow much closer together than they used to, and weather permitting, produce twice as much grain per acre.
Food productivity is more than double, so the real cost is less than half what it was 40, 50 years ago.
Julian Alston is an economist at UC Davis.
That's the big story. And that wasn't caused by subsidies. That was caused by improvements in productivity on the farm.
Farmers are proud of all that productivity, and it has driven crop prices down. But productivity aside, surely farm subsidies themselves make food cheaper. When the government picks up part of the cost of something, the price should go down, right? Julian Alston says, not necessarily.
What's wrong with that line of thinking is that it doesn't pay attention to how actually farm subsidies do work.
You see, subsidies are not the only way the government influences farmers. Some federal programs do make crops cheaper, Things like subsidized crop insurance and other traditional price supports make food more abundant and reduce prices. But some policies actually increase prices. In that category would be getting paid not to plant. Some farmers get federal money to let land lie fallow. That cuts production and raises prices. Another example would be tariffs. There's a tariff on imported sugar that tends to boost the price of all sweeteners, including corn syrup, and ethanol production, which is supported by a federal mandate, now buys up about 40% of the corn crop, again, raising prices. Julian Alston has done the math on the whole thing.
The net effect of the whole set of farm supports is to make food more expensive and actually to discourage obesity.
So farm subsidies really have nothing to do with it.
Robert Parlberg, who teaches political science at Wellesley and Harvard, has tried pointing this out.
You almost never get any interest in trying to make the counterargument. People assume that you're a crank if you dare to challenge what everyone knows to be true.
But there are some obesity experts who agree with Parlberg and Alston.
I'm very concerned about how hard it is to eat well in America today.
Margot Wootan is the director of nutrition policy at the Center for Science in the Public Interest.
Our food environment has evolved in a way that it's almost perfectly engineered to promote or cause obesity.
And Wootan says that environment isn't shaped by farm policy nearly as much as it is by food processors and marketers. Even when corn prices doubled, the price of corn flakes barely moved. That's because ingredient costs are minuscule compared to other expenses. On average, less than $1 in $5 consumers spend on food actually goes to farmers and ranchers. Shipping, packaging, processing, marketing, and selling make up the rest of your grocery bill.
Companies are really competing very aggressively to try to sell their food instead of somebody else's food, and that's promoting more and more food that Americans are eating, and as a result, we're gaining a lot of weight.
So the obesity epidemic in this country is driven by lots of factors, and U.S. farm policy probably doesn't play a big part in the problem. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris in Kansas City.